A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hannah sent us this one. She's got two antique pieces, one Art Deco, one likely from the teens, both with failing finishes and veneer that's chipping off in chunks. She wants to refinish them for a more contemporary home, slightly lighter than they are now, and she's drowning in conflicting advice. Restored all products versus full strip down. Patching missing veneer, dealing with the fact that the original finish is hiding a patchwork of different wood species, and maybe upgrading the drawer hardware while she's at it. This is exactly the kind of project where YouTube will give you 15 different answers, and at least 12 of them are wrong.
Most of those wrong answers involve a product called Restore a Finish, which was introduced in the 1980s and has been causing headaches for professional restorers ever since. It's basically petroleum distillates that dissolve the existing finish and redistribute it. If the original finish is shellac, which is extremely common on pre-1930s, American furniture, it can cloud up and turn into a gummy mess, and it does absolutely nothing for missing veneer.
A gummy mess that then contaminates anything you try to put on top of it. So we can rule that out immediately.
But let's step back and understand what she's actually dealing with here, because these two pieces are from different eras and they need different approaches. The Art Deco piece, that's roughly 1925 to 1939 in the U, characterized by geometric veneer patterns, often using exotic woods like macassar ebony or zebra wood, though more commonly walnut and mahogany. The older piece from the teens, we're talking about the twilight of the arts and crafts movement, possibly early colonial revival. Different construction techniques, different finishes, different veneer adhesives.
In both cases, the manufacturer almost certainly used what's called toned lacquer or shading stain to make cheaper secondary woods match the show veneer. You'd have beautiful crotch mahogany on the drawer fronts and cabinet sides, and then poplar or gumwood on the legs and interior framing. They'd spray a tinted finish over the whole thing, so it all read as one color. Strip that off, and suddenly you're looking at a calico cat.
And that's the core tension here. The desire for a lighter, more contemporary look versus the reality that these pieces were never meant to be seen in their natural wood colors. The correct way to handle this, if we're being practical and not museum-grade purist about it, is a hybrid approach. Mechanical stripping for the finish, careful veneer patching with high glue, and then a pigmented toner or gel stain to achieve color uniformity without completely obscuring the grain.
I want to underline hide glue there, because that's going to come up repeatedly. Hide glue has been used in furniture construction for over 3,000 years. It's reversible with heat and moisture. If someone 100 years from now needs to repair your repair, they can. PVA glue, your standard wood glue, is stronger, but it's permanent. It can leave ridges, and it doesn't play well with future restoration. So hide glue is the call for anything on these pieces.
The first thing you need to tackle is that veneer. Let's talk about how to assess the damage and make repairs that won't look like a patch job. On antique furniture, the veneer is typically between 1/28th and 1/20th of an inch thick. That's roughly 0.9 to 1.3 millimeters. Modern veneer is often thinner, around 1/40th of an inch or 0.6 millimeters. So you've got slightly more material to work with on antiques, but not much.
Which means you cannot sand aggressively. 1/16th of an inch is about 1.6 millimeters. You've got a millimeter and change between you and the substrate. A power sander will go through that in seconds.
So step one is assessing what's loose versus what's missing. For loose veneer, areas that are lifting but still there, you inject hide glue underneath. You can warm the veneer gently with a heat gun on low to make it more flexible, work the glue in with a thin palette knife or a syringe, and then clamp it with a caul. A caul is just a flat block of wood with a slight curve to it, padded with wax paper so it doesn't stick. The curve ensures pressure starts at the center and pushes outward, squeezing excess glue and air bubbles to the edges.
If you don't have a proper caul, you can make one in 5 minutes. Take a block of scrap hardwood, plain or sand, a very slight convex curve on one face, stick some packing tape on it as a glue barrier. The clamping pressure is what makes the repair invisible. Without it, you get a bubble.
For missing chips, Hannah mentioned several centimeters wide, you do need to source matching veneer. The first step is identifying what species you're dealing with. Mahogany has a distinctive interlocking grain and a reddish-brown color. Walnut burl looks almost like swirling smoke. Oak has those prominent medullary rays. If you're not confident identifying it, take a close-up photo and send it to a supplier like Certainly Wood or Woodcraft. They'll help you match it.
Let me jump in here, because this is important. When you buy a small sheet of veneer for batching, you're not going to get an exact match. Even if it's the same species, the tree it came from is different, the age is different, the oxidation is different. You cannot make a patch invisible without toning the entire piece afterward, so accept that going in. The goal is to make a clean, structurally sound patch that blends after finishing, not an invisible one before finishing.
The technique is to lay your patch veneer over the damaged area, grain aligned, and cut through both layers simultaneously with a sharp veneer saw or an X-Acto knife with a fresh blade. This creates a patch that fits exactly into the void, because the cut line is identical on both pieces. You're essentially creating a zero clearance inlay. Then you use a veneer hammer, which is not a hammer, it's a flat metal squeegee with a handle, and hot high glue to press the patch into place. The heat reactivates the glue as you work, and the squeezing action forces excess glue out and creates a vacuum bond.
The veneer hammer is one of those tools that sounds like a gimmick and turns out to be essential. It's basically the squeegee of traditional woodworking.
It really is. And the process is satisfying in a way that's hard to describe. You heat the glue, brush it on, lay the veneer, and then work the hammer in a zigzag pattern from the center outward. The glue grabs almost immediately as it cools. Within minutes, you've got a permanent bond that's also fully reversible.
Once the patch is dry, you sand it flush, hand sanding only, 120 grit maximum. And stop the moment it's flush. Do not keep going to smooth it out more. That's how you sand through the surrounding original veneer. Use a sanding block, not your fingers, so you don't create dips.
Now let's talk about stripping. Hannah asked whether she needs to strip these down to bare wood, and the answer is yes, but carefully. The finish is failing, the veneer needs repair, and she wants a lighter color. You cannot lighten a dark finish by putting something over it. You have to remove it.
The misconception that you can just scuff sand and recoat comes from situations where the original finish is intact, and you just want to change the sheen or do a slight color adjustment. That's not what we're dealing with here. These finishes are wrecked.
For veneered pieces, I strongly recommend mechanical stripping over chemical strippers. Chemical strippers, even the safe, citrus-based ones, contain solvents that can penetrate through cracks in the veneer and soften the hide glue underneath. You'll strip the finish and delaminate the veneer at the same time. A card scraper or cabinet scraper is the tool for this job.
Specifically, a number 80 cabinet scraper from Lee Valley or a similar one from Veritas. It's a rectangular steel plate with a burr rolled onto the edge. Sharpening one is a skill worth learning. You file the edge square, use a burnisher to draw out a tiny hook, and that hook shaves off finishing curls thinner than paper. It's faster than sanding, produces no dust, and gives you much more control.
The burnishing technique is the part that trips people up. You're essentially drawing a screwdriver-like tool across the edge at a slight angle, and the pressure displaces steel to create a microscopic cutting burr. It takes practice. I'd recommend spending a weekend afternoon just sharpening and resharpening on a piece of scrap hardwood until you can consistently pull a shaving. The scraper should feel like it's gliding, not scraping. If you're getting dust instead of shavings, the burr isn't right.
There's a sound it makes when it's right, a kind of soft ripping noise, like tearing silk. When you hear that, you know.
For stubborn finish that the scraper won't touch, and shellac can get very hard with age. A heat gun on low with a putty knife works well. Keep the gun moving, don't linger in one spot, and scrape with the grain. The finish will bubble and lift. But be very careful around veneer seams, because the heat can also soften hide glue. This is a work slow and pay attention. Situation, not a blasted and scrape fast situation.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure that analogy works, but I take your point. Once the finish is off, you sand lightly, 120 grit, by hand, with the grain. The goal is to smooth the surface and remove any remaining finish traces, not to remove wood. On most antique veneers, you've got about 3 to 5 passes with sandpaper before you're through, Count your strokes.
Now you're staring at the patchwork problem. Once the veneer is solid and the old finish is off, you're looking at 3 or 4 different wood colors. Here's how to make them all read as one color.
This is where the finishing chemistry gets interesting. You have 3 main options for color unification, and they work in fundamentally different ways. Option 1 is dye stain, an aniline dye like trans tint mixed with denatured alcohol. Dye stains penetrate the wood fibers and color them from within. They're very transparent, so the grain shows through beautifully, but they penetrate different woods at different rates. Poplar will drink it up and go dark. Maple will barely take it. You can end up with blotchiness if you're not careful.
Option 2 is a toned lacquer. You spray a clear lacquer that has pigment or dye added to it, so the color sits in the finish film rather than in the wood. This is what the original manufacturers did. It's very forgiving because the color is uniform regardless of what wood is underneath, but it requires spray equipment, an HVLP turbine, or at least a decent conversion gun and a compressor.
Option 3, which is the one I'd recommend for Hannah's situation, is a gel stain. Gel stains, General Finishes makes excellent ones, are essentially a thick, pigmented, oil-based stain that sits on top of the wood rather than soaking in. Because they don't penetrate, they don't care what species is underneath. They color everything evenly. You apply them over a sealed surface, which we'll get to, and you can build up color in layers.
The seal coat is critical, and it's the step most beginners skip. Before you apply any stain, gel, dye, or otherwise, you need to apply a wash coat of dewaxed shellac. Mix a 1-pound cut, which is roughly a 1-to-5 ratio of shellac flakes, to denatured alcohol. Brush on a thin coat, let it dry for about 30 minutes, and then lightly scuff with 320 grit. This seals the wood so the stain doesn't blotch, and it provides a barrier between the old wood and your new finish.
Dewaxed shellac specifically. Regular shellac contains wax that can cause adhesion problems with polyurethane top coats. Zinsser Seal Coat is a pre-mixed dewaxed shellac that works perfectly. If you're mixing your own, make sure the flakes say dewaxed on the package.
Now, Hannah mentioned wanting a lighter color. That's the trickiest part of this whole project. Getting darker is easy. You just add more pigment. Getting lighter on old wood requires either bleaching or using a whitewash technique.
There are 2 types of wood bleach. Oxalic acid is for removing water stains and iron stains, those black rings from wet glasses or old hardware. You mix it with warm water, brush it on, and it lifts those specific stains. It won't lighten the overall wood color much. For overall lightening, you need a 2-part bleach, sodium hydroxide and hydrogen peroxide, sold as products like Clean Strip Wood Bleach. You apply the sodium hydroxide first, then the peroxide, and a chemical reaction lightens the wood fibers. It's effective, but it's caustic. It can raise the grain aggressively, and it's easy to end up with a splotchy, uneven result if you're not experienced.
It's irreversible. You can't unbleach wood.
For Hannah's goal of slightly lighter, I'd recommend a different approach. Apply your seal coat of dewaxed shellac, then use a light-toned gel stain, something like General Finishes Antique White or a very light walnut. Gel stains can be mixed to create custom shades. Apply thin coats, wiping off the excess, until you reach the color you want. You won't get dramatically lighter than the natural wood color, but you'll get a lighter overall appearance than the original dark finish.
What about the situation where the natural wood itself is already quite dark? I'm thinking of old mahogany that's oxidized over a century to that deep, almost purple brown. A light gel stain over that isn't going to look light. It's going to look like dark wood with a hazy film on it.
That's the right question. If the wood itself is quite dark, if it's old mahogany that's oxidized to a deep reddish brown, you might consider a pickling technique, which is essentially a white pigment stain that settles into the grain and gives a lighter, more contemporary look while still showing the wood character. You're not trying to make dark wood look like blonde wood. You're introducing a lighter element that shifts the overall visual temperature. Think of it less like painting over something and more like adding cream to coffee. The coffee is still dark, but the overall color reads lighter and warmer.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper.
Not entirely inaccurate. Pickling is the acoustic guitar cover of furniture finishes, but done well, it can look genuinely beautiful on oak or ash, where the open grain catches the white pigment and the smooth parts stay darker. On mahogany, which has a tighter grain, the effect is more subtle. You get less of that dramatic grain contrast and more of an overall softening of the color. I've seen it work beautifully on a 1910s mahogany dresser where the owner wanted it to feel less grandfather study and more coastal cottage. The pickling took the edge off the formality without hiding the fact that it was a 100-year-old piece.
How does that work in practice? Are you brushing on the white pigment and then wiping it back? Or is this a spray operation?
You can do it either way, but for a beginner, the wipe-on approach is much more forgiving. You apply the pickling stain. General Finishes makes a specific pickling gel over your sealed surface, let it sit for a minute or two, then wipe it back with a clean cloth. The pigment stays in the grain lines and any low spots. If you want more white, you do a second coat. If you went too far, you can wipe it with mineral spirits while it's still wet and pull some of it back out. It's one of those rare finishing techniques where you can actually walk it backward if you don't like the result, as long as you haven't let it cure.
Let's talk about top coats. Once you've got the color where you want it, you need to protect it. For a piece that's going to be used in a home, not a museum, I'd recommend wipe-on polyurethane or Armor Seal. Three coats, sanding with 320 grit between coats. Wipe-on is thinned 50% with mineral spirits, so it goes on in very thin layers, which means no brush marks, no drips, and a finish that feels like it's part of the wood rather than sitting on top of it.
Armor Seal is a urethane resin varnish made by General Finishes. It's essentially a high-quality wiping varnish that's more durable than polyurethane and has a warmer look. It's my go-to for tabletops and drawer fronts, anything that's going to see regular use. Apply it with a lint-free cloth, wipe on in the direction of the grain, and don't overwork it. The solvent flashes off quickly, so you've got about 30 seconds of working time before it gets tacky.
Don't skip the sanding between coats. 320 grit, just enough to knock down the dust nips. Wipe the surface with a tack cloth or a microfiber cloth dampened with mineral spirits. Let it dry. Then apply the next coat. By coat 3, you'll have a finish that feels like glass.
Now, the drawer question. Hannah mentioned she doesn't care about refinishing the drawer interiors, which I fully endorse. That's where a lot of restoration projects go off the rails in terms of time investment. But she does want the drawers to work better.
Antique drawers run on wooden runners. The drawer sides rest on strips of wood inside the cabinet, and you pull them in and out with friction. After 100 years, that friction can range from pleasantly snug to requires two hands and a running start.
There are two approaches. The reversible, preservation-minded approach is to wax the runners. Paraffin wax or a specialty product like Slip-It. You just rub it onto the wooden runners and the bottom edges of the drawer sides, and the drawer will glide like it's on bearings. For a more durable fix, you can adhere a thin strip of UHMW polyethylene tape to the runners. UHMW is ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene. It's the same plastic they use for cutting boards and artificial ice rinks. It's incredibly slippery and self-lubricating. A strip of it on the runners will make those drawers glide smoothly without altering the furniture permanently.
The non-reversible approach is to install modern drawer slides. Blum Tandem or Accuride 3832 are the standards. This involves removing the old wooden runners, cutting a dado or using a mounting jig to install the slides, and then adjusting the drawer front so everything lines up. It's a significant modification, and it will reduce the interior drawer width by about 1/2 inch per side. The drawers will work beautifully, soft close, full extension, the whole thing, but you've permanently altered an antique.
That's a values question, not a technical one. If the piece is a family heirloom and you want to use it daily for the next 40 years, modern slides make sense. If it has significant resale value or you care about preserving the original construction, wax the runners and call it done. There's no wrong answer, but you should make the choice consciously.
I'd also add that if you go the modern slide route, you need to be precise. A drawer that's misaligned by 1/8 inch will bind or look crooked. Use a jig, measure everything twice, and test fit before you screw anything in permanently.
Let me give you a concrete case study that ties a lot of this together. A 1920s Art Deco sideboard with crotch mahogany veneer, the owner had a missing section about 3 centimeters across on one drawer front. They sourced a bookmatched piece of mahogany from the same supplier, cut a patch using the overlay method we described, and bonded it with hot hide glue. After stripping the old finish with a card scraper, they sealed the whole piece with dewaxed shellac, applied a medium brown gel stain to unify the original mahogany with the patch and the poplar secondary wood, and top coated with 3 coats of Armor Seal. The patch is invisible from 3 feet away. The piece looks contemporary, but still reads as an antique.
The key phrase there is, from 3 feet away. If you get down with a magnifying glass, you'll see the patch line. That's the reality of veneer repair. The goal is for it to look beautiful in use, not to pass forensic examination.
Another case, a 1910s oak dresser with poplar secondary wood. The owner wanted a lighter look, so they used a light brown gel stain over a shellac seal coat, then satin polyurethane. The oak and poplar red is the same color from about 2 feet away. The grain is still visible on both, but the color difference is gone.
That's the power of gel stain on a sealed surface. It's the great equalizer for mixed species furniture.
Let's pull all of this together into a step-by-step workflow you can follow this weekend. Step 1. Assess the veneer damage. Mark every loose area with painter's tape so you don't miss any. Step 2. Repair loose veneer with hot hide glue and cauls. Let it cure for 24 hours. Step 3. Cut and glue veneer patches for any missing sections. Step 4. Strip the old finish using a card scraper or heat gun. Step 5. Hand sand with 120 grit, just enough to smooth the surface. Step 6. Apply a wash coat of dewaxed shellac. Step 7. Apply a gel stain in your chosen shade, building up color in thin layers. Step 8. Top coat with 3 coats of wipe-on polyurethane or ARM, R-seal, sanding with 320 grit between coats. Step 9. For the drawers, either wax the runners or install modern slides.
Key pitfalls to avoid. Don't use Restore Finish. Don't sand through the veneer. Don't skip the seal coat before staining. Don't use PVA glue for veneer patches. And don't expect the wood to be one species under the finish.
If you want to practice before committing to the actual pieces, here's what you can do this weekend. Get a card scraper and a burnisher, watch a sharpening tutorial, and practice pulling shavings on a piece of scrap hardwood until you can do it consistently. Order a small sheet of mahogany or walnut veneer from Certainly Wood and practice cutting and gluing a patch on a piece of plywood. And test your gel stain color on the underside of the furniture, the bottom edge of a drawer front, or the inside of a leg, before you touch the visible surfaces.
The underside test is non-negotiable. Color on the can means nothing. Color on your specific wood with your specific seal coat in your specific lighting is the only thing that matters. I have watched people do gorgeous prep work and then ruin it because they trusted the little color swatch on the label. The swatch was printed on white oak and they were working with old growth mahogany. Those are not the same canvas.
You've got a plan. But before you start sanding, there's one bigger question worth thinking about. What do you do when a piece has sentimental value but doesn't fit your aesthetic? Is it better to adapt the piece or let it go?
That's the tension at the heart of every refinishing project. You're not just changing the color of some wood. You're deciding what this object is going to be for the next 100 years. The original finish was someone's aesthetic choice, made in a specific era for a specific market. Your finish is going to be yours. There's no neutral option.
There's a practical concern here that most people don't think about. The rise of these restorative products, the Restore A, Finishes, and Howard's Restore. A Finishes of the world is creating a generation of furniture that's been chemically damaged. Future restorers are going to have to deal with silicone contamination from furniture polishes, cloudy shellac from petroleum distillate products, and irreversible color changes from products that were marketed as easy fixes. We're making their job harder.
Covering the covers.
The best thing you can do for a piece of antique furniture is to use reversible, traditional materials and document what you did. Write down the products you used, the steps you followed, and tuck that note inside a drawer. The next person who works on this piece will thank you.
If you have a weird prompt about restoring something, furniture, tools, a relationship, whatever, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We'll dig into the technical details so you don't have to.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Edo period, Japanese sumshirei laws restricted commoners from wearing certain colors, but merchants exploited a loophole by lining their garments with forbidden bright silks, invisible to inspectors unless the fabric caught the light at a specific angle, making the prohibition one of the few laws enforced entirely by the optical property of opacity.
They were smuggling color.
The original, I'm not touching you, of textile law.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show. We'll be back next week with another prompt.
Until then, keep your scraper sharp and your shellac de waxed.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.